It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. Islamic State militants mount wave of attacks in Iraq's Anbar province. Islamic State militants pounded the Iraqi government security compound in the center of Anbar province's capital Ramadi Thursday. Militants used suicide car bombs against defenders of the city center. The provincial governor is calling for reinforcement and arms. Russian President Vladimir Putin accused the United States of trying to dominate international relations, but says Russia is still always open to cooperation. He spoke Thursday in an annual live question-and-answer session on Russian television, in which he took questions from members of the Russian public. Mr. Putin also said his country's economic performance has remained strong, despite a slump in oil prices and Western sanctions over Moscow's involvement with Ukraine. A prominent Ukrainian journalist known for his pro-Russian views was fatally killed and shot. Ukraine's Interior Ministry says Oles Buzina, chief editor of the newspaper Sogodnya, was shot near his home in Kiev by two masked gunmen. On Wednesday, Oleg Kalashnikov, a former lawmaker loyal to ousted pro-Russian President Viktor Yanukovych, was killed in a similar attack outside his apartment in the Ukrainian capital. Thousands of people marched through the South African city of Durban Thursday to protest recent anti-immigrant violence that's left five people dead and thousands displaced. In a suburb of Johannesburg, police used fired rubber bullets and tear gas Thursday to break up a crowd of anti-immigrant protesters aiming to attack foreign-owned shops. The violent attacks in South Africa first targeted shops owned by the foreign nationals, mainly from Somalia and Ethiopia. They have since spread to all African foreigners. This is VOA News. Syrian doctors who treated victims of an apparent chlorine attack last month in the city of Sirmin have urged the UN Security Council to hold the perpetrators accountable. UN correspondent Margaret Bashir reports.
Last month, there were renewed allegations that the government of President Bashar al-Assad used barrel bombs filled with chlorine against the northwestern town of Sirmin in Idlib province. If true, that would violate a second council resolution adopted just days before the attack, condemning the use in Syria of any toxic chemical, including chlorine, and warning a violation would have consequences. Syrian doctor Mohammed Tanari treated victims of the alleged chlorine attacks of March 16th and 23rd. He briefed Security Council ambassadors on Thursday, showing them a video of doctors unsuccessfully trying to revive naked and lifeless babies and small children. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power told reporters it moved the diplomats to tears. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
An Ohio man who traveled to Syria last year faces terrorism charges for allegedly training alongside terrorists in Syria and coming back to the United States with the intent to launch attacks on a U.S. military facility prison. 23-year-old Abdirahman Sheikh Mohammed of Columbus, Ohio, was indicted by a federal grand jury Thursday. The U.S. Justice Department said he came back from Syria intending to attack a military base in Texas and kill three or four American soldiers, execution style. Negotiators from Iran and a group of world powers will hold their next round of talks on Iran's nuclear program next week in Vienna. The two sides will be taking the framework agreement they crafted earlier this month and turning it into a final deal by their self-imposed June 30th deadline. The search for the missing Malaysia Airlines jetliner MH370 will expand. Malaysia, China, and Australia say they will double their efforts if no trace of the airplane is found soon. VOA's Steve Herman has more.
Speaking to reporters after a meeting with Australian and Chinese officials Thursday, Malaysia Transport Minister Liao Tong Lai announced an expanded search will commence to the north of the current sector in the Indian Ocean, off Australia's west coast.
If the aircraft is not found within the current 60,000 square kilometer search area, we have collectively decided to extend the search by an additional 60,000 square kilometer within the highest probability area.
Looking for wreckage in that extended area could take a year. MH370 disappeared on March 8th of last year. Since then, more than 60% of the initial search area has been covered. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
African Union observers have given their tacit approval to elections in Sudan. The head of the mission, Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, the former president, said suppression of human rights.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South African President Jacob Zuma calls for an end to attacks against foreigners in his country.
The president has taken steps to establish an interministerial committee which involves the Minister of Home Affairs, State Security, as well as the Minister of Police, to try and contain the situation, working with the security agencies of the country.
Malusi Gigaba is South Africa's Home Affairs Minister. Malawi begins repatriating its nationals from South Africa today, Friday. Gambia's main opposition leader says security forces deny him permission to tour the country. And vote counting of Sudan's controversial presidential election begins today, Friday.
All the polling stations were closed by 7 p.m. tonight. Tomorrow morning, Friday, we'll start counting, and the results will be announced immediately in each polling state.
Professor Mukhtar Al-Assam is chair of Sudan's National Electoral Commission. The African Union says Sudan's election reflects the will of the people. And Zimbabwe marks 35 years of independence tomorrow, Saturday, as some say the country is moving backward politically and economically. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Africa has expressed regrets following xenophobic attacks targeting mostly African migrants in the country. Some South Africans accuse foreign nationals of taking away their jobs and opportunities. President Jacob Zuma on Thursday appealed for calm after officials said about 116 alleged masterminds of the violence had been arrested. Home Affairs Minister Malusi Gigaba tells reporter Peter Clotty that President Zuma has constituted an interministerial committee to try and end the violence.
I think the South African government, we regret the incidents of violence which have happened directed at foreign nationals. Some South Africans have also been victims of these incidents because, as you would understand, they are quite irrational, and the victims become indiscriminate in situations of this nature. The president has taken steps to establish an interministerial committee which involves the Minister of Home Affairs, State Security, as well as the Minister of Police. These ministers have been on the ground since this incident started to try and contain the situation, working with the security agencies of the country.
So, Mr. Home Affairs Minister, when you interacted with these displaced foreign nationals who bear the brunt of these attacks, how was their reaction to them, as well as when you met their diplomats in South Africa?
All of them appreciated the very fact that we got out of our regular work to come and talk to them, to pay attention to their plight. And we've gone even further to interact with South Africans in different communities to ask them to ensure that they do not allow criminal elements in their midst to drag the name of our country down and put us into conflict, particularly with the African continent. Now, when we talk to the diplomatic corps, when we talk to the foreign nationals themselves who are displaced, they understand what our approach is. First, to remove them from the scenes of the violence and place them in temporary shelters. Secondly, to put the violence down. And thirdly, to reintegrate them, to return them back to their homes, and then to ensure that those who wish to be safely returned home are returned home. The South African government values the positive contribution of international migrants in our country.
Will this interministerial committee established by the president look into the rationale behind these attacks? Because this is not the first time such attacks have happened.
You see, there are two approaches that government is taking to this. The first one is that no excuse can be proffered to attack any other person and cause damage to life and property. So whatever your grievance is, it can never justify acts of criminality and violence. But on the other hand, where there are genuine grievances among South Africans, particularly of an economic nature, as well as social services, we will address those, including how we manage international migration, the entrance of immigrants in our society, particularly those that are undocumented. We will address those so that we can remove the powder keg which can be used by criminals opportunistically.
Malusi Gagaba is South Africa's Home Affairs Minister. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from Johannesburg. Malawi's government says it has sent buses to repatriate its citizens from South Africa, where there has been an increase in xenophobic attacks on foreigners in recent weeks, particularly in the eastern port city of Durban. Information Minister Kondwani Nakumua says the first set of buses will leave South Africa today, Friday, back to Malawi. Nakumua says as many as 2,000 Malawian migrants may be living in South Africa, and President Peter Mutharika has dispatched Foreign Affairs Minister George Chaponda to South Africa to discuss the matter with his counterpart.
The government has made a decision to repatriate. This effectively means that Friday morning, the first buses carrying Malawians will be leaving Durban to Malawi.
The Malawians in South Africa, likewise the Zimbabweans and other people from other countries in the Southern African region, they went to South Africa apparently for economic reasons. If you repatriate them, did your government make any preparation to resettle them and perhaps give them some employment?
Well, we cannot plan that now because we don't know as to how many Malawians will be affected or how many Malawians will be brought back home. Because 2 days ago, we were saying there are 420 Malawians at these three camps in Durban. But just on Thursday evening, we were informed that there is again another camp within Durban where there are 650 Malawians. So it's 650 Malawians plus 420 Malawians, and again plus two, three other camps where our officials have not yet reached. Then the figure is more than 1,000. It can be close to 2,000. Now, we cannot plan effectively on them unless we see them there back in the country. But our main concern, our main preoccupation this time around is to make sure that they are back home so that at least they are within the midst of their friends and relatives in Malawi.
There's an activist, Billy Mayaya, a human rights activist, saying that your government needs to send a stronger message to the government of South Africa besides just saying you are repatriating.
Well, as I said earlier on, that His Excellency President Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika directed the Minister of Foreign Affairs from Malawi to go to South Africa and discuss with his South African counterpart. We are hopeful that the meeting will bring something fruitful, something worth talking about. But we cannot proceed issuing a statement, a strong statement now, because whatever the case, what people need are not statements, but what people need are actions. So as Malawians, we are putting dialogue first, and the rest will follow.
Do you know if any Malawians have been killed?
Not at this point. According to the records that we have 4 Malawians that have been seriously injured, and they are being taken care of at the hospital. But as you and me are talking now, we don't have, as Malawi government, any record of a Malawian who was killed.
Malawi Information Minister Kondwani Nakumwa was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Vote counting of Sudan's April 13 presidential and parliamentary elections is expected to commence today, Friday. National Electoral Commission Chair Professor Mukhtar Al-Assam says the results will be announced immediately at each polling station. He said it is unlikely that there will be a second round because President Omar al-Bashir is very popular among Sudanese.
It went without problems. All the polling stations were closed by 7 p.m. tonight. Tomorrow morning, Friday, we'll start counting, and the results will be announced immediately in each polling state. The total results are going to be collected and announced on the 27th of April.
There was a report, Professor, that the election itself was poorly attended.
Well, you can't say this now until we count the number of the percentage of voters to registration. And, of course, you know that the percentage of polling to registration to polling is around 45% and 50%. We expect to be near that figure.
There was a report of an attack on some polling areas in South Kordofan. What can you tell us on that, Professor?
In South Kordofan, the polling stations, all of them were without problem. Yes, there were attacks on the capital of Southern Kordofan, Kadugli, and another town at Diling, and there were casualties. One woman and a child were killed by the missile sent from over the town. But polling stations were not affected.
You know, the opposition did not take part. Can you say, therefore, Professor, that this election was free and fair?
Oh, yes, quite fair, because right now, in this very moment, all the representatives of those who are participating in the elections are present and waiting tomorrow morning for the counting of the votes.
Everybody is assuming that President Omar al-Bashir is going to win, but what happens if nobody gets the majority?
If nobody gets 50% of the votes, we are going to run a second round between those two who got the majority of votes. But it is very unlikely, because it seems that President al-Bashir is the most famous among all those who are participating. There's a great chance that he gets more than 50%.
The fact that voting was extended, people say this is a reflection on the Election Commission that it did not plan for this, because it could have been worse if the other opposition parties had taken part. What do you say to that?
Well, if you take the elections of 2010, polling continued for 5 days. In this election of 2015, we made it only 4 days. So it is less by 1 day. The polling days were less. But in the previous election of 2020, there were 5 days, five consecutive days.
Professor Mukhtar Al-Assam is chair of Sudan's Independent National Electoral Commission. He was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. African Union observers have given tacit approval to elections in Sudan while noting concerns about the suppression of human rights and low voter turnout. As VOA's Gabe Jaslow reports, President Omar al-Bashir is widely expected to win the vote, which the opposition boycotted.
In a statement released at the end of voting Thursday, the AU Electoral Observation Mission in Sudan said, overall, this week's national elections reflect the expression of the will of Sudanese voters. Speaking to reporters, the head of the mission, former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, said, however, observers noted concerns that the suppression of human rights may have constrained participation.
I said there are few things that could have taken that would have made it that would have made the quality of fairness and freedom to have been enhanced. But I will not say it is absolutely unfree or unfair. But some measures could have been taken to enhance.
The opposition boycotted the polls to protest what they say is political repression in the country. Amnesty International and local activists say Sudanese security forces detained at least 20 political activists before and during the elections. At least some were released recently. For many in Sudan, there was never much doubt that President Omar al-Bashir and his National Congress Party would come out on top of these elections, which has led to some apathy among voters. Mr. Obasanjo said observers estimate only a 30-35% voter turnout, which was below what the government was expecting, despite extending polling by an extra day. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Khartoum.
Zimbabwe will celebrate 35 years of independence from British colonial rule tomorrow, Saturday, and some Zimbabweans say they are not happy the fact that the country continues to slide backwards in terms of its socioeconomic and political development. At the same time, opposition parties say there is need to address most of the country's challenges, though they remain fragmented, a situation which they say is entrenching ZANU-PF rule. Thomas Chiripasi has more from Harare.
One of the disgruntled Zimbabweans is Kudakwashe Matibiri of Harare's Highfield Identity suburb, who believes that President Robert Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF party has failed to create a democratic state since 1980.
Our life expectancy is now at 35 years. Our health system is literally dilapidated. The road infrastructure, to quote someone, if Ambuyane and I were to come back today, she would not be lost in the streets of Harare, suggesting that nothing has happened in terms of infrastructure development. So this is the sad story of Zimbabwe 35 years after independence, exactly where we were, if not in a worse position.
Matibiri says Zimbabwe needs to create a democratic environment through abiding by the rule of law, the conduction of free and fair elections, and strengthening other key pillars of democracy, like aligning all laws with the new constitution.
The question of legitimacy still hangs around Zimbabwe's neck, and until it is resolved, Zimbabwe cannot develop meaningfully.
Chitungwiza resident Edgar Gweshe says in our squabbles in the Opposition Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC, have helped in maintaining the status quo in the country.
The problem now with our opposition politics that they seem to be driven more by the need for political office at the expense of addressing the pressing issues facing the nation at large. So I think they really need to speak with one voice, come up with a grand coalition that will dislodge ZANU-PF from power and move the nation forward.
On the other hand, MDC founding leader Morgan Tsvangirai argues that pro-democracy forces should now work together to address the challenges being faced by many Zimbabweans.
The country is facing a very big crisis, and I think the elephant in the living room is that where is the end game? The end game is not going to come because individuals have their little parties. Congress resolved to welcome all members of other political parties, even former rebels, to come and join the party in order to strengthen the base to fight for a new democratic and prosperous Zimbabwe.
His views are echoed by MDC Renewal Team spokesperson Jacob Mafume.
We need a grand coalition. It cannot be grand if we are uniting with ourselves. It can only be grand if we are uniting with the people whom we were not united with.
For its part, ZANU-PF says it is doing all it can to ensure that the situation returns to normal. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Gambia's main opposition leader says security forces denied him permission Thursday to speak to his supporters. Usainu Dabo of the United Democratic Party, the UDP, says the government of President Yahya Jammeh has no regards for the tenets of democracy.
Well, we are trying to tour the country, and because in order to address the gatherings very effectively, we applied to the police for the use of a public address system. That application was submitted on the 2nd of April, and about 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon, we got a response that they want to have a timeline about the scheduled meeting. And my response was that the request was not made in good faith. They had this application since on the 2nd. Whatever further clarification they wanted, the request could have been made for that, but they couldn't wait until in less than 24 hours before my departure making such a request. And we thought that this was a refusal for us to use public address system.
Mr. Dabo, what part of Gambia are you?
We are in Niumey, in the North Bank region of the Gambia, a few kilometers away from the Senegalese border.
Now, why are you touring the country?
Well, every political party has the right to go about the country, touch base with grassroots supporters, and also try to convince others who do not support your party, try to convince them by your policy so that they can switch their allegiance to your party. This is what we are doing. And of course, we are forced to do this because we do not have access to the media. So the only way that you can reach out to your people is to go out to the rural areas and touch base with them. You cannot do it through the media.
Mr. Dabo, you've been in opposition for some time now in the Gambia. There have been so many human rights reports lately about the Gambia. What is it like for you in terms of your right of movement, a political affiliation? What is it like for you?
What is happening to me now just shows that there is absolutely no regard by the government of the Gambia for opposition parties. There is absolute intolerance for them, therefore for opposition parties in the Gambia. In fact, what is being done is to stifle opposition in the country. There is a great deal of pretense that Gambia espouses democratic values. The government does not believe in democracy. All that this government wants is to have a one-party state. And what they are now doing is an indication of what is going to happen in the 2016 elections. They now start creating all sorts of obstacles for the main opposition party, and I'm sure they would want to continue with that so that come the next elections, the opposition will be left in a situation of helplessness, and they will just go into the motions of elections just for the sake of it.
Hussein Dabo is the leader of the opposition United Democratic Party of the Gambia. He was speaking with me from the town of Sars Unyega near the Senegalese border. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with rugby. South Africa played the United States of America at the start of their campaign at the IRB Women's Sevens Series in Langford, British Columbia Province in Canada tomorrow Saturday. They later play hosts Canada and Russia in their other group fixtures. South Africa is the only African team in the 12-nation contest. At the halfway stage of the series, they are lying in 11th place with just 5 points from three outings. Turning to athletics, a new generation of young and promising athletes make their first appearance at the South Africa Senior Track and Field Championships that gets underway in Stellenbosch, Western Cape Province, today, Friday. Many are making a transition to the senior ranks after excelling at the recent Africa Junior Athletics Championships in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. On the infield, Africa Junior Men's Hammer Throw Silver Medalist Tsepang Makete will challenge the Africa record holder and 19-time national champion Chris Haramsa for the Senior Men's Hammer Throw title. Meanwhile, on the track, the World Youth and Africa Junior Women's 400-meter hurdles champion Giselle Mangaman will challenge the Africa Women's 400-meter hurdles champion Wenda Nell. Mangaman's confidence has soared since she won the gold medal at the Africa Junior Championships last month. What's more, she will be competing in front of her home crowd. Finally, in chess, the Africa Zone 4.2 chess tournament starts in Kampala, Uganda, today, Friday. The contest features teams from Burundi, Egypt, Ethiopia, Kenya, Rwanda, Seychelles, Somalia, Sudan, Tanzania, and hosts Uganda. Tournament organizers in Kampala reveal that the new rules require that the chief adjudicator comes from outside the zone of the competition. Hence, Morocco's Abdel Fattah Akouri will head the contingent of officials running the five-day event. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Cape Town, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. Here's our listener mail for this Friday morning, April 17th.
This is Bapa Adamare Fota from Gombe local government area of Adamawa State, Nigeria. Nigerians, for pure democracy, we have to relegate and discard any act of religion, ethnic, and geopolitical differences. Nigeria is for all Nigerians. For peace and stability, the minority should not force through, and the majority should not overrule the minority. Thank you. This is Bapa Adamare Fota from Gombe local government area of Adamawa State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Thousands of people marched through the South African city of Durban on Thursday to protest recent anti-immigrant violence that has left five people dead and thousands displaced. Around 4,000 people marched through Durban chanting "Down with Xenophobia" and "A United Africa" at an event attended by residents, students, and local religious and political leaders. In a suburb of Johannesburg, police fired rubber bullets and tear gas on Thursday to disperse a crowd of anti-immigrant protesters. That is it for this Friday, April 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you a very good weekend.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOANews.com. Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA,